You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Matt DiRigatis, welcome to Talking Theater Friends. I'm so excited to be talking to you today. Can you share a little bit about who you're playing in Ta-Nehisi Coates and Ruth and what makes this production special?
Okay, so I'm playing the character of Brick in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. And you know what I have found is so funny about this experience is, you know, for me as someone who does theater and is into the arts, it's, I mean, I just assume that everybody knows Tennessee Williams and Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. But like when you're talking to, you know, sometimes just, you know, the average everyday person and they're asking, what show are you doing? You know, and I'm like, oh, I'm Brick and Cat in a Hot Tin Roof. And I expect them to know right away, oh, the guy in the crutch, you know, the alcohol. I expect them to know the whole story. And it's like so many times I have found out, especially with the younger generation, that they're not aware of what it is. And to me, I think that is one thing that is what is making this production special is because we've modernized the play. So, you know, it's not the standard 1955 production that you see everywhere. I always feel like when you look at still images from the play Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, they all look the same. The sets, they all look the same. They're all dressed the same. Big Daddy has that Colonel Sanders look to him, you know? And there's that very flowery 1950s dialogue, especially with Maggie and her long, you know, speeches. And I think what has made this production special, number one, it's the first show to ever be off-Broadway. It's the first time that the Tennessee Williams Estate has granted off-Broadway rights to Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. Number two, we've modernized it. And I think that is what's making it accessible to a new generation. You know, we find there's a lot of younger people in the audience that are seeing it for the first time. And our director, Joe Rosario, you know, he's like a politician after the show talking to everybody. Hey, what'd you think? What'd you think? You know, and we're finding that a lot of the young people really love it. Also, I want to say another thing that is just making this quite interesting is it's very divisive. You've got that old guard that, you know, they love their Burl Ives bobblehead doll, you know, and it's like they can't seem to let go of like what this play should be. And we have not changed the dialogue. You know, we edited it a little bit just to take out references to 1910 and things like that wouldn't make sense for an updated version with the permission from the estate. But yeah, it's divisive. You know, you're finding that people are like, wow, this is a revelation. Like this is how it should be done from now on. And then you've got people that are like, what have you done to this masterpiece? You know what I mean? And to me, that's cool that people are so passionate about it. If they walk out of the theater not feeling anything, then I feel like we didn't do our job. But if they walk out feeling like, oh God, I couldn't stand what they did, or oh my God, this is incredible, you have to see it. And so I think that's what's making it a very special production as well. And it's our second run. You know, we got the first ever rights for the off-Broadway, and then we got the first ever off-Broadway engagement for Cat in a Hot Tin Roof. So by the time we're done running this on March 31st, it'll be close to 80 performances. So it'll be really great off-Broadway run. And I know
that's wonderful.
Yeah, and I know that I kind of glossed over the character that I played, but I play Brick, and he's a former ex-football star, and he has this questionable relationship with his friend Skipper, who has died. He committed suicide, and while not the only thing going on in the play, certainly what's orbiting Brick is, you know, the whispers of this relationship with Skipper. The possible homosexual relationship that they may have had, even though he's married to this beautiful woman, Maggie, and he won't sleep with her. And a lot of people feel that, you know, Brick and Skipper had this homosexual relationship. But what I think is so great about the character of Brick, it's pretty obvious in the text that Skipper had these feelings for Brick. But Brick is like Hamlet. You could play him in so many different ways. There's not one way to just play him. It's ambiguous. And that's what I love about the character, is like you could watch somebody play it, make a 100% choice that he is, and then watch a character play it and make a 100% choice that he's not. And I'm referring to a gay man. And that's what makes the character so interesting, is you can approach it from so many different angles.
Right, because a character like Brick is, you know, like, it's kind of, you know, not even kind of, it's totally like one of those characters that you have commented before that you have been dying to play this character for the longest time. But I'm sure that there are actors, for instance, who are probably intimidated by someone like Brick, because they are like Hamlet. They are like, you know, King Lear. They're this like larger than life characters that people, you know, like once, for instance, that you watch Paul Newman as Brick opposite Elizabeth Taylor. For so many actors, I'm sure it's this thing where you're like, how can I top this performance? But for you, obviously, it's not about that. It's about the different approach. So how did you access your version of Brick? What made you, you know, how did you find the nuance so people don't need the Paul Newman reference after they see your performance?
Yeah. So the one thing that I would say about my character of Brick versus many other variation. And I admittedly, I've never seen the movie, and I have never seen any staged version of Cat in a Hot Tin Roof. So I have no Brick to reference other than my own. And I kind of intentionally did that because I always knew someday I'm going to play this role and I want a clean slate, you know? And what I'm finding through feedback, reviews and such, is many times people play this Brick character very passive, you know, boozy, almost like in a sedated, comatose type blankness to him, you know. And my Brick is a violent, angry drunk. And I think that just adds a lot more tension to scenes and makes things a little bit more of a wild roller coaster ride, you know, rather than me just sort of sitting there glass-eyed, like, oh, what'd you say, Maggie? Water was on so loud I couldn't hear you. You know what I mean? So there's much more, I think, pathos and animation to my Brick, because, you know, not everyone who's drunk is this, you know, tired, sleepy, glassy-eyed person. I mean, a lot of drunk people can get, when they get drunk, they can be nasty. They could be mean, and that's the route that I went with Brick, for no other reason, because again, I didn't have anything to reference it from. It's not like I consciously said, well, everyone plays him this way, I'm going to play him this way. It was just throughout my researching of Brick and diving into him psychologically and really living with the character for like 3 years, because we had 5 COVID cancellations. I mean, this show was supposed to go up in 2020. So it seemed like every time we thought we were getting ready to do it and I was preparing for it, it was like, oh, we have to push it back 6 months. And then it was like, we're getting closer to that 6 month date that we pushed it back to. And it's like, oh, now we got to push it back 6 months. So it just kept getting pushed back and pushed back. And you just keep living with the character and discovering new things. And as someone who has a very strong interest in psychology, I always like to approach my characters like almost as like a psychologist. What's going on with this person? You know, because really great, interesting characters. You had mentioned King Lear. They're not normal people. They've got a lot of dysfunction and things going on that could lend itself to personality disorders or, you know, afflictions. And, you know, if you really study that kind of behavior, you can incorporate it then into your character, which is, to me, that's the most fun part of acting, is like looking at this character as if he is a person coming to see a psychologist for help. And it's like you're trying to figure out, okay, what's he got going on? What's his family like? What was his upbringing would have been like? What are people saying about him in the play? How is he acting? And then you kind of make this little diagnosis. And then when you get the diagnosis, then you start researching what you think he may have going on. And then you start incorporating that into the character. So to me, that's the greatest part about acting, is that psychological deep dive into the character, which I had 3 years to do it on Brick. He's been my patient for 3 years now.
How would you say the Brick that you're playing today is different than the Brick you would have played 3 years ago? Because something about Pat is that in so many ways, it's completely almost like a two-hander, right? Like, obviously everyone loves Big Daddy, and like, but most of the play is really Maggie and Brick in a room, which in this like really fucked up, even, I don't know, like weird kind of way, it's almost like a perfect pandemic play, because we were all forced to be, you know, dealing with whoever we live with. Like, fortunately, I live by myself for most of the time. But, yeah, you know, just the isolation that you find between, you know, the space and the loneliness that exists between Brick and Maggie, even when they're in the same room, it's just like really heartbreaking. So if you ever go and look at the notes that you took 3 years ago, how has Brick evolved and how has he changed from the Brick you're playing today?
Yeah, I mean, she has a line that she says to him in the play, you know, I'm not living with you, we occupy the same cage, you know? So it's like, that's pretty much, you hit the nail on the head with that. You know, the one thing that you can't predict, you can do as much preparation as you want, right, on a character, but you have to work opposite someone else. So I could have this idea of what I want the scene to look like or Brick to be, but it's not always going to be that, because I have to react to what the other person is giving me. So I just feel that I have to know who this guy is, and then in any situation that I'm on the stage, react accordingly to all the deep work that I've done on this character. And, you know, I think for a large part of that 3 year period, we didn't have it cast completely, and it changed. Directors changed, casting changed, because when you keep pushing stuff back, people move out of the city, or people, you know, they end up having conflicts because they were like, well, I thought I was doing this with you in 2020 and I made this commitment for this show in 2022. So, you know, it was kind of like a puzzle trying to figure it out. We brought in a new director, Joe, new cast members for the July production that originally were supposed to be different when we did it in 2020. So a lot of the work that I did on Brick was by myself, because I did not know who I'd be working opposite. The more time that we had, the more of an opportunity I had to keep just diving further, you know? So if it was going to go up on March 20, I would not have been able to have done this vast psychological profile of the character, because, you know, I might have only had 3 or 4 months to prepare from the last show that I was doing, which was the Glass Menagerie. Ironically, we did that, and then we were supposed to go right into Cat in a Hot Tin Roof. I'm a Tennessee Williams fan, as I'm sure you've gathered. So yeah, it would have absolutely been different, because I would not have acquired all of this psychological stuff. And the production itself would have been so much different. It was originally supposed to take place downtown at Wild Project, which is a great little theater down near Alphabet City in the East Village. And the budget wasn't as big as it is. But, you know, through the pandemic and the postponements, being a nonprofit, we got a lot of grants. We got a lot of support. We have a gaming license because we are a nonprofit. So we do raffles. I mean, we raised like $100,000 just in raffle tickets, you know? So we had all of this time to make this a much bigger production. So not only would my character of Brick been different, and I mentioned I'm the lead producer on the play as well. So I have so many things that I'm concentrating on. Not only did the character change, but the whole production changed, you know, and the bigger the budget, it's like, okay, well, let's move this into Midtown. And then all of a sudden it's like, okay, this is kind of a bigger deal now. We're in a bigger theater. And then, you know, we went out and we got, you know, some names to play various roles in the summer production. We had a big billboard in Times Square. And then when we got the re-engagement, we made some cast changes. We brought back some new names again. And we currently have a billboard running in Times Square right now. So the whole dynamic, I always say that the pandemic was actually the best thing that happened to this production, because it gave us so much time to raise more money, make the show bigger, and it gave me a lot more time to just go deeper and deeper into Brick. And what's interesting for me is in the summer production, I worked opposite. My two main scene partners are, as you said, you know, Big Daddy and Maggie Act One, Big Daddy Act Two. And we made a lot of cast changes coming back for this run that we're doing right now. And particularly the roles of Maggie and Big Daddy. So I have everything that I was doing in the summer, the comfortability that I got with those scene partners changed because we brought in two totally different scene partners for me, which has now then created almost a different Brick, because I'm reacting off of people that are giving me different things than I got in the summer. So it's like, it's still Brick, but it's still the character that I created from the summer, but you're now seeing different sides of him because of what I'm getting, you know? And I think sometimes these actors, they have it in their head of a certain way that they want to play the scene, and they get thrown off guard if their scene partner is doing something that they didn't anticipate. And I see it happen so often, even with very accomplished actors. They're just very set in how they want the scene to go. And, you know, the one piece of advice that I would give is reacting is the most important part of acting. Like, you have to know who your character is, but you cannot go into a scene thinking that it's got to look a certain way, because then it's just going to make the performance stale, mechanical. It's got to be alive. And when you get scene partners that are also doing what you're doing, creating new moments every night, that's what makes it fun, because it's like you go to a show on a Thursday, and then as an audience member, you come back a week later and you're like, wow, this was a totally different show. And it's because, you know, you're reacting to different things. You're discovering new moments. And I don't even know how I got to this place from the original question, but basically the process has elevated this show. The 3 years has just, I think, done a great service to the production and the people in it and our group, Ruth Stage. You know, certainly we've gotten a lot more street cred, you know, pre-pandemic. Now we're the first group ever to do Cat in a Hot Tin Roof, and first group to ever do Cat in a Hot Tin Roof and in the Glass Menagerie. So I'm trying to get Streetcar now and see if we can do the Triple Crown.
But you have played Stanley in the past, right?
I've played him in the past, but it was a regional production. It wasn't in New York City. So I want to do the all three in New York City. So we'll see.
Okay, you want the NYC Triple Crown. But if you don't mind, I want to get like a little bit like psychology, like nerdy for a second. And yeah, you have mentioned that Brick was, you know, the last character that you were missing to play the Holy Trinity of, I don't know, like unholy or holy, I don't know. Let's call it the Trinity of Brick, Tom, yeah, and Stanley. And like in so many ways, because of the ways in which Tennessee Williams writes his characters and like how he approaches masculinity, it's almost like you're playing different versions of, like, you know, like one could be like id, the other's ego, the other's super ego.
Yeah.
Like they have this like incredible qualities that perfectly fit each of this, psychological, what are they? The Freudian states, right? Of consciousness. So can you comment a little bit about, not only the physicality of the characters, but am I seeing, does that parallel make sense to you as well? Like they are superego.
Yeah, I mean, I've always said to Joe, especially during the process of me really examining Brick, I feel like Tennessee Williams really understood psychology very, very well. I mean, he just captures these traits within these people and these family dynamics. And it's like, you can like literally sit there and say, this person 100% has this personality disorder. And Tennessee Williams knew that he had this personality disorder somehow, because they've got all these little things that they're doing that just fit perfectly into what you would, consider this type of personality disorder. So I feel that Tennessee Williams understood psychology of human behavior better than any playwright that I have ever read. So that's one thing. And it's possible I'm being prisoner of the moment, because I am playing Brick and I have done it so many times now, and I've grown such an affinity for this character in this play. But I was talking to a friend recently who works for CBS, and he's a supporter of the show. We met him last summer when he covered the show and he loved it. But what he said to me when he saw it just this past Sunday at opening, he's like, I always thought of Cat in a Hot Tin Roof as the third of the Tennessee Williams Trinity, as you said. He's like, I always thought Streetcar, Menagerie, and Cat. And he's like, and now that I'm seeing what you guys are doing and I'm understanding this play and it's so clear and the psychology of it all with all these different characters, he's like, I think Cat is his best work. And it was Tennessee, famously, was his favorite play that he wrote, Cat in a Hot Tin Roof. And there is such a psychology going on with Brick, even more so than some of those other characters. Stanley, I mean, of course it's an iconic character, but he's a bit one note, I think, Stanley. He's a bit of like this gorilla in the room, and it works, but of the three main roles, Tom, Brick, Stanley, for me, I put Stanley number three. The Glass Menagerie is such a wonderful play and such an intimate portrait of a dysfunctional family, which Tennessee captures so well also in Cat in a Hot Tin Roof. And Tom's got a lot of things certainly going on as well, but not like Brick. Brick's just got so much going on, and the physicality of the role is like its whole other, it's like the crutch is like it's a whole other character, and then he's got this alcoholism that he's dealing with, and then he's dealing with his best friend, who some people think was his lover that he was in love with. Maybe it was just his really close friend that he leaned on, because he comes from such a dysfunctional family. You've got certainly a very odd relationship with his mother. It's almost Oedipal. She calls him my precious baby, and Maggie says something to Big Mama like, oh, the door's locked because, Brick's not dressed, he's not dressing yet. And, she's like, well, it won't be the first time I've seen Brick not dressed. And, then she asks Maggie, do you make Brick happy in bed? So it's like, there's just like, if my mother ever said to my girlfriend, do you make Matt happy in bed? I'd be like, Mom, So there's just like this weird Oedipal thing going on. And then Big Daddy, certainly a narcissistic personality disorder. So to me, Brick is not just a guy suffering from the friend of his suicide. There's an infidelity from his wife. Maggie slept with Skipper to try to find out if he and Brick had something going on. Everyone views Maggie as like the hero of the play, but I'm always like, whoa, we're missing like this really big thing that she did that was pretty fucked up. It's like, Oh, people say Brick won't sleep with her because he's gay. Well, no, I think he won't sleep with her because of what she did. Like, I wouldn't want to sleep with my girlfriend either if she was, you know, seducing my best friend and went through with it to try to find out if him and I had this, you know, homosexual relationship. So there's just so many things going on with Brick. And if you try to examine, like, the family that he came from and, you know, what the environment that he grew up in, and then of course having all these responsibilities as a star athlete and the pressures of being a celebrity, and then the raw, it's just so raw, it's so raw, this play, you know, it's barbaric. He's in our production, you know, he's in a walking boot because it's modern, so he's not in a plaster cast, he's in a walking boot. It's not a wooden crutch, it's an aluminum crutch. But between all of that psychological stuff going on with him, then, you know, I've got liquor in my hand all throughout the night. I'm hobbling around on one crutch. I'm using it as a weapon at points. I'm falling because I've only got one good leg and I'm half drunk. And I've got these confrontations with these people. And there's this one scene at the end of Act One where I'm chasing Maggie with the crutch. And, you know, I take one good swing and then I'm done, you know, because I got a broken ankle. So I'm just kind of crawling, chasing her with the crutch. So for me, you mentioned Freud, of course, going back to the whole Oedipal thing with Big Mama, but the real character that he's created, I think, for a male is from a real deep psychological perspective is Brick. You know, I think with a woman, Blanche is certainly something that a woman could have a field day, you know, doing like a psychological profile of Blanche, you know, in Streetcar. But I really think that Brick is his greatest male character that he's ever created, because he's added this component of the man being, you know, on one leg, hopping around on a crutch, suffering from alcohol, and then all this other stuff going on. It's a psychological dream for someone like me who loves to, again, it's like Hamlet. I mean, you have so much to just dig in, you know. It's like with Hamlet, well, why can't he kill Claudius, you know, what are the reasons, you know? So there's so many ways to approach Brick, and it's just, I just think it's such a wonderful character.
Have you ever broken a foot, or have you ever had to wear crutches for a certain amount of time?
I never had to do that, but quick little story. When I was a teenager, I'm a big pro wrestling fan. We had a backyard wrestling league, and it got quite popular in my high school days, to the point that Home Depot donated about $2,500 in material for us to make our own wrestling ring. And we made it, but it didn't have any give to it. Like, it was like a wooden base, and we were used to, you know, jumping off ladders onto like mattresses and stuff. So the first night that we had our first, like, quote unquote event with the ring, I was on the top of a ladder and I jumped off to do like a splash. If you know what that means in wrestling, it's like, you know, just sandwiching the guy off the top of the ladder. And I found out the hard way that the ring had no give to it, like the mattress, and just shattered my wrist and had surgery and, you know, was in a cast for like close to 3 months, because it was like the first six weeks they put me in a cast in hopes that they didn't have to give me surgery, and then it just didn't heal right. And so then they had to go in and operate, and then another 6 weeks I had to wear the cast. So that's the only bone, knock on wood. I mean, I did break my nose in that same sequence, but that was not as bad as the wrist. So yeah, that's the only time, like I said, knock on wood, that I've had to break, that I broke anything. But I mean, it was my right hand, you know, and I was in college at the time. So I had to have the girl next to me in class take notes on like this, like, liquid paper, where like she would write and it would seep through, you know, because I'm just like walking around like this. So I do know what it's like to have a limb, you know, totally incapacitated, but, you know, thankfully not a leg.
I'm actually recovering from a fractured foot. And before you feel like really, you know, like before you feel too sorry for me, I've spent like 2 years of my life, but in non-consecutive periods, wearing crutches, using crutches and wearing casts. And and I'm not even a pro wrestler. Like, I've only had like really, really silly accidents. But the powerlessness.
I'm not a pro wrestler.
I mean, you've tried and you're in much better shape probably than I am. But the powerlessness of not being able to just like, you know, go to the bathroom and go to the kitchen and get yourself a drink or get yourself a glass of water, it's just like really fucked up. It just really messes with you. Like, while recovering from my latest fracture and, you know, having to depend on crutches to do everything, drinking just comes so easy because it's like, it's so frustrating. And it's like this powerlessness can lead to like either just sadness or complete anger. So when have you discovered about yourself, you know, just playing someone who can't move with freedom? Because it, you know, you do it on stage and you've seen it's a pain in the ass.
Yeah. Well, you know, another thing that I want to touch on in terms of, I never broke my foot, but one night in the middle of the night back in 2019, I think it was, I woke up and my foot was in such excruciating pain. And I was like, I must have kicked the wall in the middle of the night and broke my foot somehow. And I could not walk. And I had a roommate at the time that was not around to like get me to the hospital. And I somehow got myself in the car, drove to the hospital. And when I tell you, it literally took me like 45 minutes to walk from the parking spot to the emergency room. It did. And it turned out that I had gout. And she looked at it and she's like, oh, I know what you got. Cause I'm thinking I broke my foot. And she's like, it's all swollen. I mean, I have pictures of it. It's like, it was like the elephant man. It was like, my foot was like three times the size of the other. I'm like, what the fuck did I do? And it felt like someone like cut open my foot, like stuck a wood slat in it and sewed it back up. Like, that's what it felt like, that there was just like this piece of wood inside of my foot. And it turned out that it was gout, and she gave me like a couple of pills and it was gone within an hour. It was like unbelievable. But that I certainly can, you know, reference like what that felt like. And to your question, I think the word agitation describes it best, because, you know, obviously you want to be as believable as possible when you're on the stage. You don't want to just all of a sudden walk normal for 3 seconds, you know, because the audience will spot that. They'll be like, oh, he broke character. You know what I mean? He just walked totally normal there. So you have to be so conscious of it the entire play that you have a broken ankle. And, you know, we have steps and to go out into the gallery. And I can't just walk up the steps normally. I'm like hopping, you know, it's like I'm jumping. And it's like, by the time I get to the top of that steps, I'm like, I'm a little agitated, because it's like, it took a lot out of me to hop up those steps, doing it every single night, and then falling 3 or 4 times a night because of the confrontations that I'm having and being on one foot, the injuries that I have. I mean, I've got bruises and cuts all over me, you know, so it just adds to the agitation, because I'm in physical pain during the show because of having to be on a crutch and my back is all, you know, sort of angled one way, and I'm falling, and one night I land wrong on my knee, and, you know, now, oh shit, I'm bleeding again at intermission, you know. So you want to make it as realistic as possible. And I think, you know, a lot of people have said like how intense this play is. And, you know, you want to give the audience as real of an experience as you possibly can. And sometimes, you know, like, you got to sacrifice your body in order to do that. And I'm finding out that it is getting harder and harder every night to do it. I mean, I had substantial injuries from the summer production, and then I did cryotherapy to heal it all. And I did. And injuries aren't as bad this time around, because I'm falling different than I did in the summer production. Agitation is a great word to use, and exhaustion. You know, by the time the show is ending, you know, the character Brick just kind of collapses on the bed into Maggie's arms, and so does Matt. Matt collapses on the bed as well, because by the end I'm just like, because I'm the only character that doesn't leave the stage. You know, I don't get like a, you know, 45 minute break to sit and chill while there's a big scene going on. Like, I'm in the big scenes. So I don't ever really leave the stage. And whether I'm active in the scene or up on the gallery, I'm always hobbling around, going up flights, and, you know, I'm crawling, you know, to try to get my crutch back. And it's a lot. It's a lot, but it's fun, you know?
So once you, I hope, fingers crossed, you get to play Stanley in New York City, and having completed the Holy Trinity of Williams's, you know, men, what's on your bucket list then? Like, who do you want to play next?
Well, I mean, I've been fortunate enough to play some great roles. And as someone who has sort of taken his career into his own hands by just, I mean, I haven't been on an audition in 10 years. I don't want an agent. I don't want anything to do with that side of the business because I feel like I would hate it so much. I feel like it would just suck the life out of me. It'd be so soul sucking. So it's really like my mentality has been like, okay, well, you know what? I've decided that I don't want to work in your restaurant. I'm just going to open my own. And I know that it's going to be a lot more difficult because I've got to like hire the chef and create the menu and create the cocktails and hire the bartenders and, you know, design the architecture and, you know, the food and order everything. And essentially that's what it is that I'm doing. I'm doing all of these different things. When I started doing this sort of self-producing back in 2014, I had, you know, budgets of, you know, $500 to get to do the show, you know, and then it became, oh, now I have $1,500 to do it. And then it was like, oh, now I have 5,000. And then it's like, oh, now we have 16,000. And then now we have 40, you know, now we have 200,000. So for me, I don't necessarily have any new characters that I'm looking forward to playing as much as I am excited about revisiting characters and productions that I believe in, that I felt were good, that I want to be able to bring to this next level that we've gotten Cat on a Hot Tin Roof to, which is a, you know, we're at a, it's a major off-Broadway production now. So I want to revisit the roles that I did in 2017, 18, that we didn't have the budgets for, that were well received, that maybe we only ran 12 performances, you know, in a small 50-seat theater or something. So Lone Star by James McClure, and certainly a version of Richard III that I did with Austin Pendleton. Those are the two things that are very fresh on my mind once we wrap up this whole Cat on a Hot Tin Roof experience. And then we'll see if the Williams Estate will grant us permission to do Streetcar. But those would probably be the three that are on my mind, going back to Richard III, going back to Roy in Lone Star, and then the opportunity to play Stanley. And the good thing is the play Lone Star was a success, a small success, because, again, budgetary constraints. Because it was a success, I've developed a relationship with the estate of the James McClure who passed. And, you know, they basically have said, you know, you have the rights whenever you want to do it. And then, of course, Shakespeare is public domain. So I know that I can go right into either one of those two productions after Cat. And that kind of is the plan as we wait to see if they'll give us Streetcar. And then, of course, you know, there's this off chance that depending on how successful this run goes, there are some interest from Broadway houses to bring Cat to Broadway. So we'll have to wait and see. There's some things that are holding that up right now. But that is definitely also something that would be great to do, bring Cat on a Hot Tin Roof to Broadway. So between those four scenarios, I should be pretty busy the next couple of years because they take months and months to build and fundraise. I mean, it's not like I'm going to be you know, back on the stage again in May or something, because like I said, I'm doing my own stuff. So Cat will end, I'll take a little vacation, and then we'll figure out what the next show is and start building that over the next 6 months.
If you had the opportunity to have a drink with Tennessee Williams, I mean, if you had a time machine, I guess, as well, what would you want to talk to him about? Like, do you have any questions about Brick that you would love to have Tennessee answer?
Well, it's funny because I read an interview recently. I mean, you know, the one question that I would probably want to ask him is, but I know the answer to this, but I only recently found it out. I'd say, well, what do you think of that relationship with Brick and Skipper? When you wrote Brick, do you think that he and Skipper had a love affair? Do you think that Brick is a gay character? That would definitely be something that I'd want to know, because I think people just assume that he is. But I feel like there's a lot that you could look that could point to the contrary. And again, I think that's what makes the character, you know, so fascinating. I mean, that would be a question that I would want to ask him. And I think just hanging out with him would be cool enough for me, you know. I think he's the greatest playwright of all time. I'm also a very big Shakespeare fan, but also being a conspiracy theorist, and I'm an admitted conspiracy theorist. There is a conspiracy that Shakespeare didn't write those plays, and that maybe someone else did, or maybe it was a collaboration amongst many people. So we don't really know if Shakespeare wrote all those plays. I know people want to believe it, and I would like to believe that one man wrote all of these like incredible works. And I kind of think that one man may have, but I don't know if it was Shakespeare. I don't know if it was actually William Shakespeare, but I think someone did write those plays. So they're the two best, you know, in my opinion. Shakespeare and Tennessee Williams, you know, they're like one and 1A. So just to be able to sit down and have a drink with Tennessee Williams would be great. But I think that would be a question that I would like to ask him. And I would also probably say something along the lines of, what kind of story would you write in 2023? You know, because he was a very edgy, rebellious kind of guy, which is, and our group is very edgy and rebellious. I mean, you look at our logo, it's like a skull. You know, people think we're like a motorcycle gang or something. It's like we're a theater group. So it's like I would want to know how would you push the envelope in 2023 in the way that you were able to do it back in the 40s and 50s and, you know, even in the 30s with Glass Menagerie. So like what would you do now that could be so just incredible in the way that you were able to write these plays at the time that were really so ahead of their time? That's why he's so prominent today. And I think that's also what makes, you know, I can't speak for the Tennessee Williams estate. All I know is that they support us and that they were very happy with our summer production. But I can't help but think that what has made Shakespeare last 500 years is the ability to adapt his plays into different versions. I mean, you know, you could have Hamlet, you know, in the underworld. You could stage Macbeth in hell if you wanted to. You could have, you know, King Lear on planet Mars. You can do whatever you want with it, you know. And I think we're getting to a point now where you can have some fun with Tennessee Williams's plays as well. Like, they don't have to just be set in the time that they were written, because the themes, they're universal. I mean, dysfunctional family, homosexuality, racism, bigotry, greed, families fighting over wills, adultery, sibling rivalries, narcissism. I mean, it's all 2023, you know. It's not just relevant in 1955. And I think bringing it in to a modern context kind of opens the door now for this play to have a whole series of new interpretations from other groups if they wanted to sort of take it out of the 1950s and make it modern, or even place it in the 80s or something. You know, you can now it doesn't have to just be 1955. And I think, like I said, we've gotten to a point where Tennessee Williams's plays have been around for, you know, close to 100 years, that now's the time to have fun with the plays in the way that people are with Shakespeare, and then he'll last for 400 or 500 more years in the same way that Shakespeare has.
I mean, having lived in Brooklyn before moving to Madrid, I was off the D train, and I always imagined myself as almost like a Blanche kind of figure. I'm like, there's a production of like not Streetcar, but, you know, like I guess the D train or something, like named Desire, right. Yeah. Waiting to happen someday.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I mean, and it, you know, one day there might be a D train named Desire. You know what I mean? Who knows?
Thank you so much, Matt. Would you like to invite our viewers or listeners to come see Pat?
Yeah, so it's playing at the Theater at St. Clement's, 423 West 46th Street, Midtown Manhattan. It's in the Hell's Kitchen area between 9th and 10th Avenue. To get tickets, they're available on telecharge, but you could also go to our website, which is ruthstage.org. Ruth, like the woman's name, R-U-T-H, stage, stage.org/cat. And that's got all the information on the production, the TV spots we've had, some reviews, the cast information, a link to get tickets. It's a fun website. So I encourage listeners to check it out. And you can also go to telechargeoffers.com and put in the promo code CAT, CAT23, and you can get a discount on any seat for the remainder of the run as well. So.
And I guess it's never been more appropriate to say this to someone, but, you know, the guy playing Brick, but break a leg.
Exactly.
Enjoy the rest of the run.
Hey, thank you so much, Jose. I had a great time and look forward to chatting with you again soon.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.